2014. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the Chicago suburbs. I really appreciate you joining me today on RBN. For people who can handle the truth, RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com, where you will see the names of all the guests that I've had on the program since October 23rd, 2010. Just visit my website and click on the radio schedule button. The audio files for Monday through Thursday are there. RBN expects to have their own archives back up in a couple of days. This is my last week in this time slot. I now have a Sunday afternoon program here on RBN, which will broadcast from 2 to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. I hope that you will join me then. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by visiting spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour when we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a Source Reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you for having me, Deanna.
You have been on my program 22 times, and I believe we've also done a special or two. So
yes, I didn't realize it'd been that many.
Yes, I counted it up this morning, and I thought, well, that's because you have a lot to say. You have a lot of things that we love to hear. And today you're going to talk about another one of those wonderful topics that you've covered in the past. But of course, there's always something new about the kosher food tax, right?
Yep, the kosher food tax is one of those arguments that it keeps coming back to. You keep coming back to over the period of time. You think you've done everything, it's death, and you only find out more when you read more into the literature, you read more into the kashrut literature itself as well. Just to surmise, what is the kosher food tax? The kosher food tax is a theory, and I stress the term theory because it's actually a badly named theory, whereby a large amount of money is being made off of kashrut certification of different products that people buy. It isn't a tax in the true sense of the term, in the economic sense of the term, because it is literally a business expense. It is not really a tax because it isn't actually by a organization which is being used for the common good and is known and so forth. What it is effectively a Ponzi scheme within the food industry, because like Madoff, it's based on confidence, on consumer confidence, on the belief that you'll get returns for investment, for paying the con artist money, basically. And rather than saying to people, I'm going to make you millions and millions of dollars in investments, like Madoff did, what the kashrut food tax, or what you like to call it, is based around the concept of firms. Well, firms, you'll get lots and lots of consumers buying lots and lots of more of your products if you certify kashrut. And it's this idea of consumer confidence that lies at the heart of the kosher food tax. And an interesting subject and related to the kosher food tax is the fact that we don't think a lot about the Israel lobby and how it's funded. We think a lot more about what the Israel lobby does, what it's going to do next, what it's proposing. What we don't think about so much is where it gets the money to do that from. And it takes a lot of money to do what they do. So the answer has to be, where is that money coming from? Now, it's very easy, again, just to sort of do a sort of wave-away answer and say, well, Jewish control of banking, Jewish control of the legal profession, and so forth. However, I think the truth is actually more prosaic because, yes, these areas of Jewish power do have a lot of money and they do generate funds for the Zionist cause and the Israel lobby, as well as the Jewish cause more broadly, but yet it doesn't ring true, because the amounts of money involved, unless you're talking to the banking industry, are not sufficiently large. And they're also very much on the radar. So in the banking industry, there's a lot of regulation, there's a lot of oversight, and the same holds true of the legal industry. But the answer is, well, if you've got those kind of regulations in place, it's very difficult to take lots of money, put it into your personal bank account, and give it to a foreign agency lobby and a well-known one. You can't really do that. But the key thing about the Israel lobby is we have to understand its history. In the 1950s, 1960s, it had a direct relationship with Israel. The American Zionist Council, which is the precursor of AIPAC, was funded by the Israelis directly via several conduits. And then it dispersed the money to other organizations. It acted basically as a clearinghouse, as a money laundering operation. And in 1963, the Fulbright investigation discovered this, and relatively quickly, with a couple of researchers doing a bit of digging. It didn't take them long. It didn't take the chap after who's named Fulbright to discover in cross questioning that what he was dealing with a concerted attempt to evade the law. That was the law in question being the FARA law, the Foreign Agent Registration Law, Registration Act, and it's from there. The AIPAC has rebranded itself, if you like, as being domestically funded, because it can no longer be funded by Israel, because it's too easy to spot. So in order to evade all the law, they need to be domestically funded. Now, the fact that the kosher food certification industry takes off at just the same time as AIPAC is getting started in the world as we know it today is very suggestive, but it's not necessarily conclusive. However, I think there is other information that suggests there is a direct link between the two. In further, the kosher food tax also disadvantages American business by increasing their cost base unnecessarily and thus impacting the average American's pocket. And the cost involved, in spite of claims to the contrary by people like the ADL, is necessarily considerable, because it's a bit like having additional strict health and safety regulations you have to follow. Business cost is necessarily considerable, because otherwise kosher certification would not be the mark of quality that it is claimed by both the ADL and every other Jewish organization out there.
I could see where you're going with this, and... Oh, this is incredible. This is really amazing.
It's frightening, isn't it, that you think about it? But
yes.
There's even another angle to all this, the fact of espionage. Now, you might think of espionage as just stealing military secrets. That isn't the sum of espionage. Espionage is also about commercial warfare. And when the free trade area between the Israel and the United States was created, via the lobby, in large part, in the early 1980s, the lobby obtained an entire copy of the American bargaining position with all the commercial data that was attached to it from American companies. And these American companies were not military manufacturers as a rule. They were shoemakers, food producers, and what have you. And food, incidentally, is one of Israel's major exports, oranges particularly. This data was then passed onto the American companies' Israeli competitors in digest form by the Israeli government, incidentally, the trade deficit between Israel and the United States is over $1 billion a year, and is rapidly increasing, and the cumulative trade deficit is now getting towards $70 billion, which is frightening in itself.
Oh, my. All righty. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Deanna, our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. The very, very first trade agreement that the U.S. entered into was with Israel in 1985. We have all heard of NAFTA and CAFTA and some of the other agreements, but very, very little about the one with Israel. So please continue. This is fascinating.
Well, just to briefly enlarge upon that, a Harvard economist actually pointed out that the Israel trade agreement was the worst trade agreement that that US has ever made, because it violates every principle, because the US gets nothing out of it, but Israel gets a lot, because Israel is a parasitic economy. It doesn't have anything else other than weapons, food, and to the point where there was actually a collaborative committee, I can't remember the name of it, set up to fund research between the United States and Israel. And this committee was entirely American funded. It was set up in the 1970s. It was set up and it was entirely American funded, but yet Israel got all the benefits and then sold the resultant technology that the American government has paid for to back to the Americans for money. Now that's again another frightening aspect of this particular relationship. It doesn't help that, and related to the kosher food tax, that Israel is well documented to be involved in patent theft and violating these in order to address their chronic trade imbalance. That is why they fundamentally steal technology from the United States and sell it to the highest bidder, which is often China, North Korea, Iran, Russia, whoever. It doesn't matter. Just as a little aside, for those of people who think that Israel won't sell to anyone, Israel was selling arms quite happily to the Khomeini's Iran in 1981, after Israel had stolen billions from the Shah. As part of the nuclear program, which is another frightening aspect of this particular country. Now, to give you some idea of how big the kosher food tax is, according to the latest industry figures, which are called the Mintel reports on this subject, approximately half, more accurately 40% of every food item that is offered for sale to you as a consumer in America has been kosher certified. Now, that's a frightening enough figure, but then you get into the actual value of that. That is some $200 billion of food sales that have been kosher certified, which are generated every year, with an industry worth $500 billion in sales a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, you begin to wonder immediately, how is that then supporting the Israel lobby? Well, if you think about it, the Israel lobby doesn't need that much money. That amount of money is insane. But the APAC, for example, APAC's average revenue every year is $50 million, according to their IRS filings. But if you probably include the probable slush funds they've got, we'll probably about double that to $100 million. But still, that's nowhere near the amount of profit that could be made from a $200 billion industry. Latest estimates put the entire kosher industry at something in terms of value, in the region of $5 to $10 billion a year. And we can quickly then see where APAC is getting some of its money from, as well as what Grant Smith terms the Israel AstroTurf PACs. He doesn't know about the concept of the Innocence Committee from Monzenberg, but it could be. And this, if we just think of this as one revenue stream, and that if we've got one revenue stream producing this much funds, then it begs the question: where on earth is all the other revenue that the Jews necessarily get going? And again, to give you a sense of scale, in 2007 alone, 4,784 new products were kosher certified. Compare that to 2,245 all natural products and 1,636 organic products. It's a rough comparison, but it gives you a very good idea of just how big this industry is getting. And again, we've talked a bit about the term kosher, but we haven't actually talked about what it means. Now, one of the big problems with any literature you tend to read on the kosher food tax is the fact that, unfortunately, there is a lack of understanding on the proponents of it, of what kashrut is, and more particularly, its extent. Kashrut is not purely to do with food. Kashrut applies to everything from clothes to utensils to detergents that you use in your house. Anything you use which can come into contact with your body is to do with kashrut. So, for example, kashrut cloth must not have two threads. It cannot have cotton and wool or what have you together, because these are two threads. Thus, they are regarded as being treif, forbidden in Hebrew. Therefore, they're not kosher. Therefore, the Jews cannot wear them. So that means that if a person wants to sell kosher clothing, which again does exist, then they have to abide by a whole different set of rules than they would if they were just competing on the open market. And as Andrew Heinz says in his 1990 book, Adapting to Abundance, which is published by Columbia University Press, kashrut is the principal differentiating factor between Jews and Gentiles in everyday life, and was a series of rituals conceived and added to over time to have with this purpose almost directly in mind. So it's intended to make the Jews into a people who stand alone, a people who are separate. And this concept of kosher is derived from a very, very literal understanding of the Torah, the written Torah, as what you would know as the Septuagint, the first five books of the Old Testament. And one of the principal elements of kashrut is what we call shishishta. And shishishta, for those of you who don't know, is the method of Jewish slaughter. Now, Jewish slaughter is a very, very, very controversial topic, because the shishishta market alone in the United States today is worth $12.5 billion and has witnessed rising sales in the last 5 years due to the propagation of the belief that kosher is better, kosher is healthier. Now, just to say, this idea that kosher is better quality is complete nonsense. And anyone who knows anything about kashrut would tell you the same. The reason why is because kashrut is not a health-related set of regulations. It is a set of regulations about ritual purity. Sometimes they might cross over into the possibility of having some health benefit under specific conditions, but things like, for example, not having two threads in a cloth, not baking a calf in its mother's milk, and so forth, is not a health-based regulation. It's a ritual regulation.
Okay, and there's a difference between those two.
Well, yes, because a ritual is a religious ritual. A religious ritual is based upon the assumption that divine law says this. I therefore do that in order to not to violate that. Now, divine law can or cannot be related to health. It doesn't have to be. There's no reason for it to be so. Health is often not tangential to rituals. For example, in Jewish ritual you have the keeping of, you have the spreading around of the bread, the unleavened bread. Sorry, at Shavuos.
Sure. All righty. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader, and many, many, many articles. Oh, my goodness. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Please visit this website and study all of the articles that Carl has up. It is an education all in itself. It is amazing. Some people think that if they eat kosher food that they're not going to be getting GMOs and other contaminants. What is your view on that?
That isn't reality, that isn't actually true. Because, first of all, in the entire food industry, Kashrut has the longest history of, shall we say, of corruption in Kashrut. Now, this can be very easily demonstrated by pointing out the fact that you've got two levels of kashrut. You've got kosher and you've got galat kosher. Galat kosher is supposedly the top level of kosher. And at this point, all that is being done, for example, in a case of a cow being killed, is that a rabbi comes along, rather than, and once the animal has been slaughtered to their satisfaction, they then cut out the lungs, and they then fold the lungs out sideways, out, so they slit them, then fold them out, and then they will inspect them to the nth degree to try and find any imperfection. Because if there is any imperfection in the lung, that then means that the cattle cannot be glatt kosher. But if there is perfection, it can be glatt. Glatt just means better kosher. And the fact that the kosher food industry has a huge problem with, shall we say, people pretending to be kosher, because to the point where you have reported sections on every American kosher certification organization, which allow someone to actually say, well, this product, I don't think this product was kosher enough. Can you go look at it? Because I found, I don't know, a piece of meat in it or something. You've got enforcement bureaus for kosher, which is, again, is indicative that you've actually got a real problem with, people pretending something is the case than it when it isn't. But also, it's worth understanding that Kashrut itself there is no quality benefit there. All that's happening is that a product that you would buy on the shelf normally is being switched to another supplier, or is being got from another source, or killed in a different way. That's it. That's the entire difference. Because all that happens in the kashrut certification process is that the rabbis go through all the sort of what we call the food supply chain, and they then take out anything they consider not to be kosher. So, for example, anything that is created by genetic modification is not in itself not non-kosher if it meets all the other requirements, because kashrut has not yet formed a distinctive opinion on GMOs, if you're genetically modified organisms, because kashrut opinions take a long, long time to form. And to give you some perspective on that, there is still a shishishta debate going on in the current kashrut world from the 1700s between the chassidim, which is the Hasids, and the non-chassidim, which is everyone out, which is all the other Jews. Mm-hmm. Because the Chassids claim that if you slice, that if a, well, no, probably better if I actually read you the text from Samuel Friedman's The Book of Kashrut. Between the years 1770 and 1790, one very volatile difference between the Chassidim and the other Jews developed around the method of sharpening the shishishta knives. The Chassidim adopted the custom of burnishing their shishishta knives, and at the same time honing the blade to an extremely fine sharp edge. They claimed that only by preparing the blade in such a fashion could the shoshet, which is the ritual slaughterer, inspect his knife carefully enough to say that any imperfection could be easily discovered. The other Jews objected to the use of the highly polished knives because they complained such a finely sharpened blade was easily prone to denting, which is forbidden by Jewish tradition as a shishishta knife, because it tears rather than cuts the flesh. They argued that the blade, so finely sharpened, became nicked with the very first cut into the tough skin of an animal that was slaughtered, and this put a special burden on the shishet to sharpen the knife after each killing. What's more, they contended that every knife blade might become damaged even during the first act of shishita itself, and thus the very first animal could become nebela, which is nebela equals imperfect, thus the shishet cannot slaughter anymore that day. So it gives you a flavour for the fact that they're not actually doing anything different to improve the quality of the of the food. All they're doing is having a fight with each other, or trying to war against Gentiles, we call Gentile non-Jewish standards, to try and claim that what they produce is better. But what all they're doing is adding ritual to it. They're not actually adding any quality or inspecting any quality to the actual product. Probably if I could find another scandal or two, which I probably can at some point. Let me just have a quick look. I can't find that at present. But to get back to it slightly, to give you some perspective as to why, as to Kashrut itself, in the 1950s, 1960s, the Jews demanded and were eventually successful in forcing the meat industry to use specially constructed pens for slaughtering that were designed for Kashrut purposes. And it cost the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals some $200,000 in the mid-1960s to design a pen required by the Jews, and each of these pens cost $12,000, which profited the Jews since they held the patent. Specifically, who held the patent was the Joint Distribution Committee, of course, or a Zionist
organization. Oh my gosh!
And thus they made undisclosed but huge amounts of money out of it, and you can guess where that went.
Sure. Oh my goodness. This just gets so involved, and you've gone down all of these proverbial rabbit holes to oh my gosh. Yeah, and here we thought it just had to do with those little symbols on our food, and that was but who would have thought that this was behind AIPAC and behind and who would have thought of the free trade agreement? I mean, it's just amazing. Amazing.
It actually gets even worse. if that's actually possible.
I'm sure it is.
But let's see, where was I? The concept of shishta and kashrut in general is something that's well known to any animal rights activists out there. Because from the 1970s till present, they have long been targeting shishta and kashrut certification in general as being an exceptionally cruel process for animals. And they've wanted to close this down at numerous occasions. Now, I'm sure you've all heard the Nazis banned shishta, the Nazis banned kashrut, ooh, evil Nazis. But kashrut was first banned not in Germany in 1933. The kashrut was first banned in Switzerland in 1893. Was the first country to do it, and it did it not because evil anti-Semites got together and conspired against the Jews, but rather because animal rights came to the fore, and people said this is not a humane way of killing animals. And even the Soviet Union banned shishta in 1917. Although it did allow it again in 1922, and then decided to ban it again in 1927, as you go. It's worth mentioning that kashrut itself is not a single entity. It is a group of different levels of regulation that are applied by different Jewish religious groups. So the traditional custodians of kashrut are the Orthodox, which are the middle of the road radicals, if you like. Whereas the conservatives have their own brand, so do the ultra-Orthodox. The ultra-Orthodox and the Orthodox tend to be the ones who prevail on the matters. But it's worth bringing up the fact that kosher certification, as we know it, first came into existence as in its present form in 1923. And the first ever product that was actually certified with a symbol was Heinz vegetable beans in 1923. However, the first ever product with a kashrut symbol on the packaging was the product of the Agate Nickel Steelware Company in 1901 with its tableware ranges, which again puts the lie to the fact that kashrut is not just about food. It's about the utensils you eat with food and so forth.
Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, I never thought of utensils like that. Oh, okay. Oh my goodness, alrighty. We'll be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. guest today is the one and only Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. That's something that everyone should have. And his website is SemiticController.blogspot.com, where you will find all kinds of wonderful, wonderful articles. Please visit that website. All right, please continue. This is fascinating. Very informative.
Before the break, I was sort of semi-searching for example of the corruption in the cashless industry. Just to read you again a passage from Seymour Friedman's The Treasury of Cashworth.
How's that spelled? K-A-S-H-R-I-T.
There's two ways of spelling Cashworth. Either you spell it K-A-S-H-R-U-T-H, or you spell it K-A-S-H-R-U-S.
Okay.
In this case, it's the T-H.
Okay.
So what he says on page 95 and 96 is, as a representative of Judaism, although in a limited way, a kosher catering hall must not permit violations of the sanctity of Jewish life, so that those who come to celebrate an occasion of life will not be given reason to think that so long as the place is kosher, all other irreligious and unsavory activities may go on under the protective umbrella of Kashrut. The Catholic Department of the United Synagogue, which I'll come on to in a little bit, does not accept for kosher supervision any kosher catering which is served on the Sabbath or on holy days. He then continues on, etc. And then he says, he dare not accept any gratuities, this is about kosher supervision, he did not accept any gratuities from the suppliers of food to the catering establishment as a result of his having approved the purchase of a kosher product. On one occasion, Magalish, who was employed by the conservative movement as a supervisor, wrote to the suppliers of a catering hall where he was supervising Kashrut, asking them to make contributions to a charity which he was interested in. Those suppliers who did not respond to his appeal were denied further business from the catering to the establishment by order of the Magalish. When knowledge of this extortive practices became known to the Kashrut departments, the Magalish was suspended immediately from further service to the Kashrut department. And it gives an idea, that gives you just a very small idea of the corruption that can occur and does occur in the Kashrut. Because all that was one supervisor saying, I want kickbacks for supplies. You can imagine how big it gets when you start getting into the large corporations who want Kashrut supervision. And again, in this case, it's a different work, but it's worth reading to you because it does actually explain how this actually works in some respects. Let's see. So, for example, so where's it gone?
This is just amazing information.
Okay, here we are. This is from Sue Fischikoff's Kosher Nation, which was published in 2011 or 2010, I think, by Schocken. 2010 by Schocken. She says, changing certification can bring down the rash of the kosher consumer and can prove to be just as costly as dropping it altogether. In 2002, rumors began flying that Stella Odorio, which since 1958 had been kosher in Pave, which means neutral in the literature of Kashrut, was about to start using dairy ingredients in its cookies. Kraft Foods, which took over the company in 2000, wanted to use cheaper chocolate than contained milk. And she goes on to the outcry was immediate, etc., etc. Without PAV status, they were less useful. Boxes of Stella Oreo cookies stamped with a new dairy label with anticipation for a change of layer unopened for months, blah, blah, blah. And according to this outcry, in January 2003, Kraft scrapped its plans to change the recipe.
Oh, my. Now this book, Kosher Nation, that is Kosher Nation, why more and more of America's food answers to a higher authority.
Yes.
By Sue Fischkoff.
Who's a Jew and who works for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency.
Oh, my.
So
okay.
She's not exactly a sort of anti-Jewish source in the slightest. But just give you an idea of how much kosher costs. Again, on page 18, she says, kosher cruises joined the market in the 1990s and cost twice as much as non-kosher trips. In early 2009, a seven-night Alaska cruise with Kosherica, the country's largest kosher cruise company, which, of course, no one who's not studied kosher knows exists, started at $1,957 versus $1,025 for a similar non-kosher cruise. So it gives you an idea of the cost of kashrut that is involved to the consumer. Not just the companies, this goes straight to the consumer, and that difference, a good part of it will go to the Israel lobby, as I have said. Now, an important point to understand in kosher certification is people often think, it's for the Jews of the world. Yeah. The Jews, it's for the Jews because all the Jews, of course, keep kosher. Wrong.
Sure.
According to the latest Jewish national population survey, only 1 million Jews keep kosher in the United States.
Oh, and my gosh. So 300 million people have to, or more, I guess 340 million, or however many the population is now. And so for 1 million who do actually keep kosher?
Yep. And they can't even, because the ADL in the 1990 article on this claims that this was also, that the kosher certification was also used by Muslims as well as Seventh-day Adventists. Now, there aren't many Seventh-day Adventists, but there are quite a few Muslims. But the idea that Muslims are using it is wrong, because the Muslims have, since about the mid-1990s, had their own version of the kosher food tax. They've had their own halal certification going on because they found the Jews were making huge amounts of money off this. Well, why would they not get involved as well
in order
to do the same thing for Muslims? And to give you, and again, one thing I haven't really touched on, I meant to mention it briefly when I quoted Friedman, was who enforces kashrut. Now, the people who do it is the kashrut department of the United Synagogue of North America, which is the Orthodox. The authority was delegated to them in 1966 to do so. After it was decided that the initial kashrut board set up in 1919 was insufficient to the task. Another example of the scale of kashrut involvement is the fact that in New York, there is an entire department of the governmental apparatus overseeing kashrut, the Bureau of Kashrut Supervision, I do believe, and enforcing it via the use of police resources, and this was all created in 1934.
Oh my, now New York was one of the first states that actually adopted kosher food laws. Correct.
Yep, and interestingly, while there are literally over 1,000 certification organizations in the United States at the present time, and that's a frightening number in itself, there are four big ones. That's the Orthodox Union of Manhattan, OK Kosher of Brooklyn, Star-K of Baltimore, and Kof-K of New Jersey. Now, we can very much see very quickly what they're all centered around. New York City, pretty much.
Right.
And to give you again some more perspective as to what that looks like, if we've got over 1,000 today, in 1981 in the United States, we had 18.
Oh my.
In 30 years, that has gone from 18 to over 1,000.
Oh my goodness.
Now, how, if the ADL are right, how is that possible? If they're not making money, why are there over 1,000 of them?
Right.
And it's, you know, even if you assume a small amount of money, they still must be making a large amount of money in order to stay in business, and also for new organizations to keep entering the business. And again, to give you some perspective, that if we think about today, we've got over 40% of all food in the US being bought every year is kosher certified. But in 1970, there was only 2,500 certified food products from 475 companies under the Orthodox Union, who were then the big one, the big certifier. And kosher supervision alone from... Whoops.
We are already at the top of the hour. We will be back at 6 minutes after the hour, and I hope that you'll stay with us with our guest. This is fascinating information. Be back at 6 minutes after the hour. Angola Speaks. This is Deanna. And please remember that I will be starting my weekend show, my Sunday afternoon program here on RBN, which will broadcast from 2 to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. I hope that you will join me then. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a Source Reader. His website, which is filled with wonderful, wonderful articles that everyone should read, is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Today we're talking about kosher food. It just goes deeper than a few symbols on some packages of food.
Mm-hmm. A lot deeper.
Indeed.
As I was saying, in 1970, there were 2,500 certified products, which from 475 companies under Orthodox Union casual supervision. And again, the Orthodox Union was at that time the largest and still is the largest of these organizations. This was up from 1,830 products from 359 companies in 1961, while in 1945, it was only certifying 184 products by 37 companies. Now, we can see from that how far it has come in the last, 70 years or so. Quite some way. And the power of that, flow of money has got to be linked to the Israel lobby, in large part because we know the Orthodox Union donates to Israel lobby parts of it. So, for example, in the 1990s, the Orthodox Union donated, I think it was $10 million to the World Jewish Congress. And the World Jewish Congress, as everyone knows, is one of the big overarching Jewish organizations. So it's one of the ones that says, I'm going to allocate money to you, I'm going to allocate money to you, I'm going to negotiate with a government here or a corporation here. So it's one of the big ones that actually does something. It's one of these ones that has a more of an advocacy purpose, general advocacy purpose rather than a specific purpose, unlike APAC, NORPAC, ICEPAC, people like that. Again, the key thing to understand in Kashrut is the cost is not borne by the people who are actually using this product. Products. Fundamentally, it's the Jews and Muslims and Seventh Day Adventists who can use that as the basis for their own beliefs. But everyone else is paying for a small minority to have their products certified. And to give you an idea of how much havoc kosher certification organizations can cause. In 2007, all the kosher certification organizations in the United States withdrew their certification of pre-cut lettuce and pre-cut cabbage and so forth because they claimed that they had revised their opinion that these products could not be considered bug-free unless they'd been hand-checked, which required more employees and so forth. And this, of course, sent the entire food industry into a bit of a furore, because all of a sudden, in order to maintain part of their business that they believed to be key to their profitability, their kosher business, because remember, corporations are affected by a kind of groupthink quite frequently, whereby they don't want to lose any market share, and they believe that this market share is essential to them, even though the market share actually costs a lot more money to get at the market than it does in actual profit, in return profit to the actual company. Because corporations don't always act what we call the rational economic man. They don't always take economic decisions. They take fashion-based decisions. Because if the corporations were purely rational, they wouldn't go out of business.
Right.
And it's this kind of thing that causes absolute havoc in the food industry, because they then have to go and resource a new food, a new source supplier. They have to change their processes. And that's millions upon millions of dollars that have to be somehow recouped from, and the people they will recoup them from are their customers.
Right.
So, and of course, it's the Jewish organizations which actually have the lists of all the suppliers that are kosher certified. So they give for example, H.J. Heinz, they give H.J. Heinz a list. H.J. Heinz say, well, we'll look at all these now for our purchasing function. They go away, but this organization, the Catholic organization, gets a finder's fee for actually telling the organ, the H.J. Heinz, or you can go to this farm in Israel that you can get it from. So they're paid by the people who are on their list and Heinz themselves for the privilege of recommending. Okay, aka a finder's fee. And of course, we have no actual numbers for these finder's fees, but they have to be considerable. To give you again some idea of the amount of changes in a business that are required, quote Friedman again, because he's quite good at being blatant about, it says, while in most cases, whatever changes in production are recommended involve only foods going into the product, and again, that's a considerable change, bear in mind. Occasionally, the report of the rabbinic committee is such the company must undertake extensive structural revisions, such as adding a new wing, before the CAFO certification will grant the product a U certification. Once a company has been fully approved for cash for certification, the supervisory fee is set by mutual agreement between the company and the KCS. The fee is often kept low in accordance with the non-profit policy of the KCS. Often in large production, the fact that thousands of pieces of the product are produced makes it possible for the company to absorb the minimal cost of the supervision without substantially raising the market price of the item. Now, the problem with that is that it's not actually true, because it requires you to have economies of scale. It requires you to be producing thousands and thousands and thousands of this particular product, and also to be selling them to this market. Because bear in mind, quite a few of the products that are within the kosher set are specifically designed for cash-proof users. They're not designed in any way for the average non-Jewish or non-cash-proof person who wants to. Who doesn't care about it? They're designed, they're designed with the Jews in mind, and it's that which links them. It's this kind of ability to make huge amounts of money by charging a large by finder's fees, by consultancy fees, because you have to have rabbis in there and so forth. But again, to bring out a point, just give the lie to it being cheap. A good example is wine in Kashrut. Kashrut wine requires, and there is no exception to this, that the wine be entirely handled by Jews. It cannot be handled by Gentiles.
Really?
It cannot be handled by Gentiles, otherwise it's tlief. Why? Because Jewish law, halakha, believes that non-Jews are absolutely prone to what is called in Judaism evil urges. Evil urges can mean anything, from bestiality, homosexuality, to poisoning Jewish wine, killing Jews, or just deliberately making things tlief. Because Jews have a persecution complex and believe that Gentiles go around deliberately making their wine and their food non-kosher. Which is probably surprising to many people who have never really studied the Jews, but they really do, and it's in all the response literature that you can read on Kashrut. And again, another key point which gives a lie to it being a cheap cost is the fact that in order to keep an eye on Gentile employees, there has to be Jewish supervisors around a kosher-certified factory. They have to be rabbinical supervisors there at all times, because they have to keep an eye on what the Jewish employees, the non-Jewish employees, are doing if kosher food is being made, because Jewish law stipulates that they will, again, that non-Jews are prone to deliberately unkosher the food of Jews.
So, oh, my gosh. All righty. We are going to a break, and we do have some callers lining up. We will be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is semiticcontroversies.blogspot.com. Would you like to take a caller, or would you like
yes,
to...
Yes, why not?
Okay. Okay, let's take a caller. Let's take Leafkin in Ohio. Leaf, welcome. Hi.
I guess this show has really shattered what I thought about kosher food. I thought of it as a conspiracy, obviously, but not to the scale. This has certainly, shattered all my assumptions on kosher food. It seems like I was looking at the rabbit hole instead of reaching down in it and actually seeing where it went. I think this also shows, the power that these lobbies have, especially the Israel lobby, getting this money, the connections that he's made. I know that yesterday there was a report out that $1.7 million in gift packages and trips and golf outings were given to congressmen just by one lobby of Israel. And surely some of this money has come from there. I think this also speaks to Jewish supremacy. They always want to talk about the supremacy of other races, but it's clear to me just this whole business here, whether it's about food or whether it's an extension into other things, you could tell the idea of Jewish supremacists have really planted the Jewish supremacy, into this kosher business here. And I was wondering, since the guest has wrote about communists, our last program that was on RBN, a gentleman was talking, he has a good show, but he kind of makes a connection between socialism and communism. And lots of shows, not just on RBN, but most shows make this assumption that they're both the same thing. And I was wondering if his book covers that and, kind of separates the idea between the two. I know that by the title you can tell it almost tells of the origins of communism, of course, being a Jewish invention. But I was wondering if it covers the separation of the two, because I think in this country, unfortunately, they get their idea of socialism from Barack Obama and people repeating that that is socialism and somehow connected to communism. Does his book cover any of this?
No, it doesn't cover that particular split, although there's quite a lot of different academic books on the subject of communism and socialism and how they're actually different, because communism is a way to socialism. It is not socialism itself. Socialism is, effectively, socialism is a form, is an ideal state. Mm-hmm. Communism is a way to it. Anarchism is a way to it. What they call gradualistic Marxism. People like the Social Democratic Parties, the Labour Party of Britain, the SPD of Germany. They all believe in trade union socialism, which is again a way to socialism rather than, shall we say, the end result. The confusion comes because in post the Bolshevik Revolution, people were talking about socialism, and they meant purely Marxism. They meant one form of socialism, and that's kind of become the way people have associated it. And the Second World War again, this idea that socialism is Marxism, socialism is totalitarian, and so forth is not necessarily true, but it is the general perception people have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I had a question about the kosher business.
Yeah.
You were talking about the Israeli lobby, and I know there's so many lobbies out there, and there's so many groups, AIPAC, JDL. Any of these other groups receiving money that you can track down?
Yes, because the thing about the Israel lobby, and I would suggest picking up the work of people like Grant Smith, it's quite useful if you're a bit unclear, is... It's actually a series of organizations. For example, you talked about the holidays. And the people who organize the holidays are called the American Israel Education Foundation. And they are a part of the full corporate structure of AIPAC. But yet you wouldn't know they're part of AIPAC. You wouldn't know that the Brookings Institute, which is, again, a massive old think tank, which was purchased by AIPAC and I think Douglas Feith in the 1990s, was, again, controlled by AIPAC now. and you've got all these different little organizations which go on layer upon layer upon layer, and they all have the how it's all interlinked is by using the same people and in positions of power within those organizations. So, for example, 23% of APAC's directors are also directors in WINAP, so the Washington Institute for Near Eastern Policy. And WINAP is the sociable element of the Israel lobby. It goes out and has academic conferences, debates, and so forth. And that's how it all works. They use crossover of people. And if you trace the people, you tend to trace what organization is doing what.
Mm-hmm. I had one more question about kosher. Okay.
Go ahead.
The connections between the two, between the groups there, does that attract attention from Israel? I know, I guess I'm wording the question wrong. Netanyahu recently came here, and he spoke at the AI PAC, and the interestingly enough, he left Washington straight for Hollywood to talk to Hollywood executives, which I think just is hilarious because of the stereotype, and obviously speaks to the truth between the connections of Hollywood and Netanyahu. But does he actually get together with these people in this movement, or do they simply end up at one of these Hollywood parties or end up in Washington and get spoke to?
He sort of gets involved. The reason why is because, of course, Netanyahu is a Jewish nationalist, and he's an observant Orthodox Jew. And as part of that, he must have contact with senior rabbis in Israel. Senior rabbis in Israel are part of the what you call the kosher industry, because they're the people who fundamentally set a lot of these rules and make the major rulings outside of what they call the Zaddiks. The Zaddiks are means literally pious person, pious man, who tend to live in places like Brooklyn, and they have their own little subsets, like the Satamar Chassidim, the Lubavitch Chassidim, and what have you. So he would he would have contact with them, but not so directly. But yet he would also have contact with the lobbying arms of these kosher organizations, because the Orthodox Union, for example, has an arm called, I think it was the Union for Public Policy Analysis or something, which is actually part of the Orthodox Union. And if that is what I think it is, which is a organization for the promotion of Israeli interests, then it would be part of the Israel lobby and would form a direct connection between the largest of these kosher organizations and the Israel lobby more broadly. But as I said in my presentation, I think it was about 20 minutes ago, we do know that the Orthodox Union and people like OK Kosher have contributed large amounts of money to Israeli organization, pro-Israel organizations in the United States, because remember that the Israel lobby has to be seen to be domestically funded, because the minute it becomes funded by Israel, it's liable to be smashed by the FBI. Because we know from post 9/11 that the FBI quietly rounded up 4,000 to 5,000 Israelis and just deported them point blank. Didn't ask questions, just did it.
Right.
So the FBI knows, has an idea of what it's dealing with, but it's paralyzed by the political power of the lobby.
Wow. All righty, we are going to a 3-minute break, gentlemen. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle, the author of Communism and the Jews, a Source Reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. And we are talking about kosher food and its many, many implications and infiltrations and all kinds of things. And we had Lee from Ohio. Did you have another question or comment?
I'd just like to make a real quick comment that this is why this show is so important on RBN, and why I said that it should be on 8 days a week, is because you'll never hear about these things anywhere else. And how important is this kosher food business? I think that you can clearly see the connections between all these lobbying groups and the kosher food business. And it's it's opened my eyes quite a bit. And I understand, as many people do, that these lobbies are the ones that buy our government. Most of the representatives in the United States are bought and paid for by these people. So this may very well be a large chunk of how they're getting this done. The money doesn't fall, off the trees, if you will. And after the show, I'll immediately be going to the website, of course, which will probably have much more information. I just want to say it's been great listening to you on the weekdays. I hope I can listen to you on Sunday at times. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take Steve real quick in California. Steve?
Well, my question isn't a kosher question, but your speaker seems to be very knowledgeable on Israel. So I the question
he's
I'm
brilliant.
Ask is
he's brilliant.
Yeah, he's a pretty sharp guy. Two questions, because it's very so much, but what is the amount, the actual dollar amount, economic aid that we, as the United States, gives to Israel? What is the actual number?
That's a very good question. And the short answer is that no one really seems to know, which is an unfortunate thing to say, but it's actually the truth, that we've got... I'm trying to find a very, very brief... amount for you, but if memory serves, it's about like 3 or 4 billion or something. It works out as per year in pure, a US fund, US to Israel, to funds. But but the problem with that is you have to account for balance transfers to Israel. You have to account for the trade deficit. You have to account for all the donations that go from Jewish organizations to Israel, and the fact that Jewish organizations often have Israel offices, which they shift assets to Israel, then they move the asset to the Israeli economy. So it's very difficult to get an actual concrete number. However, most estimates I have read will be between $4 and $8 billion a year that you're talking, and that is not including in-kind assistance or technology or whatever that is given to Israel. In addition to all of that, because as I'm sure you know, Israel aid to Israel has been ring-fenced by Congress to prevent it ever being altered, changed, or put down, as as it can only be increased.
Okay,
oh my
the second
gosh.
Question I have is, this has been going on for quite some time. I'm not sure when you can tell me when they actually started keeping some kind of records of how much we've been giving them, but it's been a long time. But my second question would be then, they always talk about Israel, the standard of living in Israel is so poor, they're paupers and everything. And if you do the math and you say the numbers, the billions and billions that have been going on for the last, let's say, 30 years or more, so why are they still playing that card of we're so poor, we need your economic aid? When they said, if this is true, then the government's been pocketing it, and the people have never received any of this aid anyway.
More or less the truth, because Israel spends, 25 to 30% of its income on its armed forces, and probably another about 10% on its security industry. That is a huge amount of money to spend on your armed forces, your security industry, and it was something in the region of Israel has been an economic basket case since the beginning. In fact, Israel collapsed economically in the 1970s because it couldn't keep up with the amount of money that was being required by its armed forces every year. But to answer your question, we can actually tell you when it all started, because we actually know that. One of the few things we do know. The formal aid from the US government started in 1949. From the very beginning, it was originally much smaller, but Israel, in the early days, for example, stole U.S. Army surplus from bases in the United States by taking note of the times the guards would do their rounds, and then driving a truck in there with people in U.S. Army surplus uniforms, loading it all up and flying it to Nicaragua, And then flying it all the way from there to Israel. And it's and one of the great unstated things of the Israel lobby, that the Israel lobby has been absolutely key in propping up pretty awful dictators in Latin America and the Middle East, because of the fact they're willing to trade with Israel. And if they're willing to trade with Israel, Israel will support them with their Israel lobby. A great example is Nicaragua, when you had Sotelo, who was in power from the 1930s to the 1970s, and who was buying, who was the biggest customer of the Israeli defense industry from in that period, more than any other thing. This one dictator was killing his people at a huge rate, and it was doing it with Israeli weapons, and the Israelis were happy to sell them to him. In much the same way, the Israelis pretty much set up the Savak, which was the Shah's secret police, and their entire torture section, or the interrogation section, was trained in Israel in how to torture people, effectively. It's this kind of mentality that drives the Israel economy, because the Israel economy is based on we must spend lots of money on a military, because we're scared that we're going to get overrun by the Arab states at some point in the future. So it's like a constant state of emergency. So they constantly spend more and more money on their military, and they never have enough to spend on all these other programs. But they've also got a lot of corruption. Israel is quite high on the corruption ratings. And also they have lots of odd exemptions. Until recently, for example, any Talmudic student, or ultra-Orthodox Talmudic student, didn't have to do national service. So loads and loads of Orthodox students were Talmudic and were supported by the state, by the Israeli state. So the American taxpayer was paying for ultra-Orthodox chassidim in Israel to attend the yeshiva, to become rabbis.
Right. Let me ask one other further question
Sure.
Pertaining to that. Now, I've always looked at Israel and the Jewish people as separate, very separate. I do not like the Israeli government. I see the corruption, the evil there, what they're doing and how they have manipulated our country and basically own our Congress. They own our Congress. Now, keeping that in mind, is there an opposition from the people in Israel to say we are not like our government? Is there a pull away, or is there a resurgence of the population of Israel to say, you know, this government is out of control, very much like our government is out of control with the power? Is there kind of a pull away from the population from that? We don't want to be recognized as being like them, the government?
No, to be honest. There was originally the Israeli Communist Party, which was very much that kind of position. But there was a massive debate. There was a massive split in the 1970s where the Arabs and the Jews and the Communist Party went their separate ways, because the Jews believed that Israel had to be a Jewish state, which is contrary to communist doctrine, but okay. But there is a group. There are groups in Israel which oppose it. There's like Israeli, I can't put the top of the head what they're called, but there are a couple of them. There's also some ones in the United States, such as the True Torah Jews, the New Tricate, who are ultra-Orthodox Jews. But as I pointed out before, the difference between groups like that and the Zionists is actually not as big as often thought. The reason why is because the ultra-Orthodox believe that when the Messiah turns up, they will rule the world and they can do what they like. But the Zionists believe that they shouldn't wait for the Messiah. They should do it now. And that's the fundamental difference. The opposition groups in Israel are small, and they are often more right-wing than the Republicans, than if they are anti-Israel. It's quite bizarre, because Israeli politics is what you would characterize as far-right as standard. There is very, very few left-wing voices in Israel that will actually oppose Israeli doctrine in regard to that Israel must be a Jewish state, pure and undivided.
Right. And, of course, a lot of them are benefiting financially and with homes and whatnot in the new Israeli settlements. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, we are going
Thank you, Deanna.
All righty. Yep. Thank you so much for calling in. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader, along with hundreds of articles that you can find on his website, which is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Today we are talking about many things, including the kosher food tax. We do have one more caller. Let's quickly take Jerry in Chicago.
Good afternoon, Deanna and Carl. Real good. And, you know, you started your show with talking about the kosher meats. I'd just like to do a plug for a YouTube video called Earthling. It's approximately an hour and a half long. If anybody can stomach watching it and the things that they pull on these animals and how they treat them and everything, it's just disgusting. But the other thing I wanted to mention, too, has nothing to do with today. But, Deanna, I'll tell you, a year and a half I've been listening to you, and a year and a half I've been taking notes, and a year and a half I have been learning 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I got to say, thank you very much, and I'll be tuning in on Sundays. You guys have a blessed day.
Thank you, Jerry.
Deanna, we did have a the caller before last. He asked for specific data around the cost. I'll just quote the Harvard economist Thomas Stauffer on this. He says conflicts in the Middle East have been very costly to the United States as well as to the rest of the world. An estimate of the total cost to the U.S. alone of instability and conflict in the region, which emanates from the core Israeli-Palestinian conflict, amounts to close to $3 trillion, measured in 2002 dollars. This is an amount almost four times greater than the cost of the Vietnam War, also reckoned in 2002 dollars. Similarly, aid to Israel, and thus the regional total, also is understated, since much is outside of the foreign aid appropriation process or implicit in other programs. Support for Israel comes to $1.8 trillion, including special trade advantages, preferential contracts, or aid buried in other accounts. In addition to the financial outlay, U.S. aid to Israel costs $275,000 American jobs each year. Another element is ad hoc support for Israel, which is not part of the formal foreign aid programs. No comprehensive compilation of U.S. support for Israel has been publicly released. Additional known items include loan guarantees, which the U.S. most probably will be forced to cover, special contracts for Israeli firms, legal and illegal transfers of marketable U.S. military technology, de facto exemption from U.S. trade protection provisions, and discounted sales or free transfers of surplus, in quotes, U.S. military equipment. An unquantifiable element is the trade and other aid given to Romania and Russia to facilitate Jewish migration to Israel. This has accumulated to many billions of dollars. Lastly, unofficial aid in the form of transfers from the diaspora resident in the U.S. and net purchased by U.S. parties of Israel bonds adds at least another $40 billion to the total. A rough estimate, again a minimum, for such additional elements is more than $100 billion since 1973. U.S. jobs and exports also have been affected, adding to the costs and losses. Trade followed the flag in the area, but in the reverse direction. As U.S. relations with Middle East countries deteriorated, trade was lost. Worsening political relations resulted in the loss of hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs. Some disappeared as a consequence of trade sanctions, some because large contracts were forfeited thanks to the Israel lobby, as in the case of the foregone sale of fighters to Saudi Arabia in the 1980s, and still others due to a dangerously growing trade imbalance of Israel.
Oh my goodness. And then when you factor in the corporate outsourcing of production in this country, much of which is orchestrated, facilitated by Jewish-owned corporations or Jewish-controlled corporations, we see that also adds to, the destabilization of America, correct?
Yes, it does, because it's fundamentally Israel taking jobs or moving jobs to countries to help it, so that it can, for example, get better relations. And better relations is one of its primary targets at the moment, has been since the 1990s, China. To the point where Israel has been selling China U.S. technology for so long that it's become almost accepted practice that if you give it to Israel, you give it to China. And it's that kind of mentality that completely destabilizes the United States. Jews support immigration. They support, might call the sodomization of society. They support everything that destabilizes the United States. A great example is abortion. You've got, I can't remember the name of the Israeli billionaire, but one Israeli billionaire supported, I think it was Sheldon Adelson actually, he supports progressive abortion in the United States. But yet he is ferociously anti-abortion in Israel, to the point where he funds one organization that goes in and goes to Jewish women who are going to have a child and who have contacted an abortion clinic and says, have the child, we will look after it, we'll give it a good home, and we'll give you some money. But yet in the United States, he's funding abortions.
So, oh my gosh.
How do you square that one? Because you can't unless you realize that he's a Jewish supremacist, as people like to call them, who regards, well, non-Jews animals would be the best way of putting it.
Of course. Yes. We are all cattle.
We are all cattle. Or soulless husks would be the best way of putting how the Jews view non-Jews. And the second caller from last actually brought up an interesting point. He said Israel is not Jews. Well, by accident he made a bit of a faux pas there, because in Judaism, Israel means the Jews. So when we talk about Israel in terms of Judaism, it means the Jews, and Jews defined by biology, not by confession. As Jews by confession would be converts, and they're viewed as Jews, as Jewish souls born in non-Jewish bodies. Thus, they're impure.
Oh my goodness. Well, this has certainly been a program full of information, and we can, getting back to the kosher food tax issue, there are many symbols. They use many symbols, and this isn't just in this country, but this is throughout the world, because each country has its own set of symbols to look for. And I think if people look at all of the products that they have in their cupboard, and it's not only that, because when you consider the prepared foods, if people use prepared foods, that many of the things that go into that preparation are kosher certified products or ingredients.
Correct. Because they have, if fundamentally they have to use the cheapest product around, and one of the most common sources of cattle for beef for non-Jewish consumption in the United States is from kosher certified butcheries, slaughterhouses, because the shishita process is so exacting that it has to be killed in a very precise way. If there are any deviations at all, that means that it's tough and has to be. And is immediately then sold off to the goyim, to us, to eat. And the Jews in 2011 got really uppity when Switzerland, again leading the way as they tend to do, suggested that consumers ought to be able to be told that their meat had been slaughtered by shishita methods, not by the normal sort of stun gun or the bolt gun or what have you that is used. And the Jews threw an absolute fit about this, because all of a sudden it would be exposed to how much of the product that we get via the slaughterhouses is actually from kashrut slaughter and has had effectively a Jewish charge or paid for it. And the kind of hilarious thing about that is the fact that the Jews in the United States in the early 20th century used what they called a plumber to mark Jewish food, which was simply a metal tag applied to the food to indicate the fact that it had been kosher slaughtered. And the fact that they wouldn't then use the plumber for the same food, for the same, basically the same thing, doesn't indicate the other way, it suggests that the Jews are deeply afraid that if this becomes widely known that kosher food is, that their food is being slaughtered, that people's food is being slaughtered by Jews, or by Jewish methods, then there'll be a boycott of it, and that they will then lose their monopoly, and they will lose their funding, and then it will all kind of, if you would, unravel. Because if it unravels, they don't have any more sources of income of that scale.
Wow. We should unravel this entire scam. Oh, thank you so very, very much for being on the program today, and I hope that you will be able to visit us on Sundays.
I will.
Okay, super, super, super. Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners. Thank you. And please tune in at 2 o'clock on Sunday. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.